Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Jason Hazley.
I'm Joel Morris.
And as usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works. Or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is Miles Jupp.
Hello.
Hello and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Welcome to the den.
I've made you sound slightly dangerous then, didn't I?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that good? Do you like to cultivate an air of danger?
I would love a sense to be dangerous, yeah. Selena Cadell, do you know Selena Cadell? The other night she said to me, yes, I don't think you realise how dangerous you are.
Whoa.
And I thought that was really exciting, yeah.
Wow.
Were you rewiring a plug badly or something?
I was giving her a lift. No, I wasn't. She was referring to she's co-directed a play I'm in, and she was talking about that. But anyway, I took that as an enormous compliment.
So dangerous as an actor, then?
Yeah, presumably. I perhaps that means we just don't trust you. You're untrained. I had collided with one piece of furniture that night, and there's only three on the set. So maybe it was all about that, and it wasn't a compliment. Perhaps it was a note. I've taken it as a compliment.
A lot of acting's about working out where you're meant to be, isn't it?
Acting is about, and nearly every job in comedy or even like presenting is looking like you're meant to be there. That's all it is. You know, if you're presenting a sort of corporate awards ceremony, Velcro Innovation of the Year or whatever, people will say, well, why would you present that? And there is no reason why you'd present that. So the job is to look like you're meant to be to try and look like you're the right fit.
It's why people who've got a natural sense of entitlement can be massively over-promoted. All that happens is that if the audience's first reaction to seeing you do anything, whether you're a politician or an actor, is, sorry, who are you?
Yeah, they shouldn't be there. Yeah. Well, it's like, I suppose, doctors. It's entirely about reassurance, isn't it? Yeah. I was once, it's the only thing where I live. We were at a church service and we were up in the balcony and someone keeled over. And there was a guy sitting next to us who's a doctor and he went down. And after a while, the person who keeled over just sort of sat up. And when he came back, I said, what was wrong with them? He said, I've absolutely no idea. And I said, so what happened? And he said, well, they were all panicking. And then the daughter said, does he need an ambulance? And so I said, no. And then he just sat up.
Wow.
And that was what was required to be. It's basically, I find that even though I'm very, very late 30s, there are times in life you think, I just need a grown up to tell me if this is the right thing to do or not.
Is there anyone on the plane who could pretend to be a doctor? Unless Lee Nielsen just steps forward and goes, I've got this.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly that. Yeah, yeah. Could Hugh Laurie please come to economy briefly? He doesn't have to stay.
That turned up in Simon Singh and Edzard Ernst's book on alternative medicine. Really interesting book called Trick or Treatment, where they did double-blind tests on alternative medicine. And the only conclusion they come to is that alternative medicine, it's any medicine that has failed.
But it just has calm practitioners.
What it is usually you've paid for it. And because you've paid for it, the person who you're talking to has loads of time. And a GP on the NHS is very, very busy. But private medicine and alternative medicine are the same, because usually you pay for it privately. So the people can give you their time. And Simon's conclusion, which was brilliant, he said, well, the conclusion we can come to is traditional medicine would be far more effective if you could work out a way that the doctor looked like they were really paying attention. Because it apparently just reassures people and their body kicks in and they start looking after themselves. He said, weirdly, he said, it's all down to the bedside manner. He said the bedside manner of all the alternative practitioners was absolutely second to none.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
You'd given them money.
It was quite often when you're talking to a doctor, they're also typing, aren't they?
Yes.
And you think, is this, I mean, if you had to take another work? she's franking envelopes. This is outrageous.
Playing the piano.
Hang on a minute. Oh my, yes, I just got a little bit of air traffic control on the line. It's only a small
private
vehicle.
Respraying
a car. Yeah. Anyway, you sound fine.
Yeah.
But someone told me recently about a doctor. This does link into what we're going to be talking about, I suppose. Vaguely, but it was about a doctor who was so fed up with people that are going and Googling all their, coming up and saying, I think I've got Chinese river blindness and things like that. That their approach now with people that say, now look, I'm worried and I've done a lot of reading, is he says to them, so that they know that he's the real deal, he says, okay, you tell me what your symptoms are and I will tell you what you think you've got.
Wow.
And when he gets that right, then they... He has their confidence.
It's great. It's like a parlour game.
But when he gets it wrong, it must be really awful. It must be awkward. No, it's not that. No, I think I've got a cold. You've diagnosed something awful.
See, there's a format.
It's probably on 4 Extra. Guess what's seriously wrong with me?
Yeah.
It's sort of quite. You could have it on quite late at night, and it could be quite ponderous. Illness is a hilarious thing sometimes. I love Bill Bryson, especially the travel ones. And there's one, A Walk in the Woods, about the Appalachian Trail. And there's a paragraph that I find unbearably funny, which is literally him... just describing the symptoms of Lyme disease. And it's just really, 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 really funny. If you Google the line, no less arresting is Lyme disease, this paragraph comes up in the book. And it's just brilliant. And it's just a list of maladies with about maybe 2 extra sentences that he's had to adorn slightly.
Well, that's the key to Graham Chapman and Chris Morris. And there's lots of people who just use medicine very funnily. Medical reviews were a big thing for a while, weren't they? So people who were training to be doctors.
Well, that's what people like Phil. Well, obviously Dr. Phil Hammond. But
Graham
Tony,
Garden?
Yeah, but Tony Gardner as well.
Really?
Tony Gardner was in a double act with Phil called Struck Off and Die.
Yes. Funny doctors. What you're talking about here, then, is something which is very, very relevant to the thing you brought in.
As
which
it
is
turns out.
A professional, very professionally done. But the idea of a veneer of professional competence over, obviously, massive personal incompetence.
Yeah.
There's something just inherently comic about a doctor not coping. Do tell us, what have you brought in for us to examine today?
Well, I have Frasier.
Breathtaking.
Don't be greedy. Your turn was over 40 seconds ago.
All right.
You know the way you do it isn't right, don't you?
We're simply admiring a very rare Brancusi armchair, not a naked woman.
That's what I'm talking about.
I am a very, very big fan of the American sitcom Frasier. There was a time in the 90s on Channel 4 where I think Friends would be on at 9, yeah. And everyone would watch that. And then some people... at 9:30 would watch Frasier.
The
and
better I, people, you mean?
Well, I'm not. It's not for me to say, but history will...
We call ourselves the 9:30ers.
Yeah. History will decide, yeah. I went to a boarding school, so on a Friday night, you would watch sort of television till late, and everybody would watch Friends. And that's one of the things that got me into comedy, was that the sort of communal aspect of it, being in a room full of people watching. You know, you end up watching stuff on your own a lot. And I went to see Spamalot in New York with David Hyde Pierce in it. And one of the things I realised about 10 minutes in it was like, oh, wow, I've always watched Monty Python. I've always watched just me and my brother. It's amazing when there's another 1,500 people as well laughing.
Yeah.
And so that everyone would watch Friends, and then everyone would just sort of get up. But there was this guy that I knew, James, and he said, there's a thing on after Friends that I think you would really like. It's got this guy in it that really reminds me of you, actually. and that's how I watched it. And I just loved it. I really loved it.
Look, I know I don't have your total support in this, but how shall I put this?
You don't care?
If you could work the phrase rat's ass into there, you'd have it.
When it was Paramount, they used to have 2 episodes back to back, 5 and 5:30. And I was at university and I would run back to my flat in Tollcross in Edinburgh to watch an hour of uninterrupted Frasier. Which turns out I could have done in the morning.
It's one of the things, I mean, it just occurred to me, that one of the things that happened when we went multi-channel, when we went seriously multi-channel, was a lot of the American imports got parked onto digital channels. So Friends is now on E4 or whatever.
Yeah.
Everyone's nostalgic for the TV of their childhood. And you look at it, and so much of it wasn't made in the UK. That your big drama of an evening wouldn't be The Bodyguard or Dr. Foster. It would be Columbo or Kojak or Starsky and Hutch or The A-Team. It would all be imported stuff, which is now on sort of tends to be on digital channels or on Fox or Sky or whatever.
Yeah.
But British television was really focused on getting a top-class import in to anchor its viewing for a big comedy night. It would say, it'll open with Friends, it'll have Cheers.
That's your big signing, isn't it? That's your, in county championship terms, that's your overseas player. You know,
let's get
Virat Kohli in for three games. You know, that's what's happening there.
But I think culturally it's left us in a very funny place where, I don't know, a perfect example, I'll profess an ignorance now. I've seen one episode of Modern Family. In the 90s, that would have been on Channel 4 at 9 o'clock on a Friday night, I would have watched it.
Or the BBC at 1 in the morning.
Community, all those shows that you have to go and seek out now, used to just be thrown at you, thrown at the mainstream. And I think they really helped. You can see some, I think, slightly in British comedy, when they try and do a mainstream hit now, they're still copying those really, really big American hits of the 90s. They're still copying the rhythms of Friends and things.
Yeah.
And you think, well, I think if you watch what's actually been coming out of America, it's changed rhythms completely since then. And so a lot of British sitcoms feel quite old-fashioned. Sort of they're following Seinfeld or Larry Sanders. But because that was the last time everyone got around and went, these are huge hit shows. What's a huge hit show? And you go, well, it's Frasier, Friends. Thinking, these are
but it was presumably also matched the demographic of the people making them. So, if you know, Cheers, you know, that'd be written at the sort of that time in your life when you're not all that busy and it doesn't quite matter and you're hanging around in bars, and then you know people, you think they shouldn't be hanging around in bars as much as they are, and then you know, suddenly you get to a point when you're a bit more grown up and you are sort of living in a family environment, and you think, oh, that's when you'd write something more about a kind of family environment or whatever. So like Friends, I suppose people would watch going, you know, that would must have been lots of people in flat shares watching Friends going, which one are you, you know, who are we like, or whatever.
Well, that was written because they'd had this brainstorm about saying the traditional family sitcom, and it was someone had spotted or read an article about the urban family, that people who were concentrating on their careers or were unable to afford to start families and things were having an urban family of Friends.
Yeah.
And then we can have exactly the same dynamic with two little kids and a mother and a father. The wacky neighbours. It's a family sitcom, but they did it with people of the same age.
Well, I know one way you can look at Frasier, I suppose, if you just sort of muddy the lines a bit, you know, if you think of Niles and Frasier, it's basically you've got a couple bickering. That's sort of what it is. Yeah. You know,
they're cast as siblings, but actually they're husband and wife.
Yeah, that's how the dynamic works.
Well, the stroke of genius, I think, with Frasier, when you look at how they assembled it, and the original idea was to do, because Frasier's a spin-off from Cheers. Cheers is a precinct sitcom. It's people who are in inverted commas in a workplace. It's like it's like Brooklyn Nine-Nine or Taxi. You throw people together who shouldn't be together.
But Frasier was going to be a workplace sitcom.
It was going to be a radio thing, wasn't it?
It's all going to be set around KACL and stuff. Yeah. But it gets enough earth there, and it's got. But I suppose then they become they're sort of, you know, people like Bulldog and Gil Chesterton.
Yeah.
You know, they're well rounded, but they're cameos, aren't they?
They're in a scene with them.
Yeah, and you're like, this is definitely going to be a funny bit, isn't it? They've not dropped Bulldog in to really drive the narrative.
Hey, sports fan, how they hanging?
Okay, Bulldog.
I was talking to Roz.
Then Roz, who's the sister, I suppose, of one of the married couple, and Frasier, you know, then she sort of straddles both camps. She's really brilliant. Perry Gilpin, who plays Roz Doyle, absolutely amazing.
Rewatching this, I watched Frasier when it was on, and I loved it, because we're both huge Cheers fans. So for me, Frasier has always been the Cheers spin-off.
Yeah, yeah.
Even when it was one of the biggest shows in, was it 38 Emmys? It's one of the most successful sitcoms of all time. But to me, it always feels like it's a Cheers spin-off.
Yeah.
But I'd forgotten. I remembered the thing you remember about Frasier. It's clever, it's witty, it's farce, it's stagey, it flatters the audience's intelligence, all those things. But I'd forgotten it is completely adorable. It's also all about loving the characters.
It's really full of jokes as well. It's got proper jokes in. But then it's all earthed by John Mahoney and Perry Gilpin. They're the sort of people, they've got their characters that can do life. They find, Frasier and Niles as ridiculous as we find them.
You know, Frasier, I'm getting just a little tired of your constant insinuation that I sleep around. I didn't get any sleep because of that idiot, Chopper Dave. When he gets bored doing traffic reports, he likes to buzz people's apartments in his helicopter.
Oh, I can see how that would be annoying.
Well, it didn't bother me much, but the guy was with his Vietnam vet, and he started having flashbacks.
It's a thing that I thought was amazingly clever in Cheers, which I think, again, they'd learned from Taxi. And you can see in The Simpsons as well, is that when a joke pings into the pinball, when you fire a ball into the pinball machine, it has to bounce off as many mushrooms as possible on the way out.
Yeah.
Which is how Cheers worked. And what you did is you made sure that you'd got all the different sorts of people in there.
Yeah.
So if you're doing something which is set in a very, very rarefied atmosphere like Frasier is, very, very high-end, intellectual, cultured thing, you need some earthy people in there. You need a Carla. You need a coach. You need some people there who have got...
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
Those two tones, which are very delicately added in, and beautifully in the case of John Mahoney's character as Martin, where his chair has been dropped in to ruin the furniture of that flat.
Yeah, yeah.
And the number of jokes about furniture in Frasier. Frasier is the thing where the art department is doing a level of joke and character as well.
But also, it was one of the most extensive sets in television. I mean, everything in it is real. That's a Bludner piano and stuff like that. Because David Hyde Pierce plays the piano brilliantly. When I saw Spamalot, he would play the piano during the big sort of Camelot scene. I was very, very excited to see him on stage. I was really beside myself. And then it would have been 2004, something like that, and I was with my brother in New York. No, 2005. And I don't know why I thought that I would be alone in this, but I remember at the interval saying, just going to go out and see where the stage door is, and then maybe afterwards I could sort of get an autograph or sort of meet him or something. Of course, you go to the stage door at the end of the show and there's sort of 300 people. But I did, I waited, and then they had, you know, like barriers set up. But I waited, and he came out. I remember asking, please, may I shake your hand? So I shook his hand, and then he signed my playbill. And then, I suppose now, it sort of dates it, but I thought, oh, I could have taken a photograph, couldn't I? And I didn't think to take a photograph. And so I said to my brother, do you mind if we wait? And so we waited, and eventually he came around again, and I said, can I have a photo with you? And there was someone between me and the railing, and he was sort of trying to work out. I said, it's fine. I mean, they can just be in the photo too. That's, you know. And he went, no, it's all right. And he sort of climbed up onto the railing and then leant over. And we took this photo. My brother took it. And then he said, is it a digital camera? Again, this dates this story. Is it a wax cylinder? and then he said, check, you're happy with the photo. My brother said, oh, you're blinking in it. And he said, I was. And so he just climbed up and we took it again. And I remember just walking off down the street thinking, he would have been there for another hour and a half.
Wow. Know?
Just remember sitting in a bar going, everyone in the world could be like him, couldn't they? He seems amazing.
Yeah. I went to see a friend the other night who's in a show in the West End. And afterwards she came out and it was the same thing. There's a lot of people waiting there at the stage door. And she hung around and had lots of selfies taken with people and signed a few programs and things. And she said, this is actually the third act when you're in a show like this. The first two acts are on stage and the third act is at the stage door afterwards. You've got another hour
after
you leave when you're still at work.
Sort of real, yes, of course, yeah. And it's a bit more of an intimate setting then.
Yeah.
William Goldman's brilliant point about saying, the thing about a great actor is not only can they play the part on stage, but when they come out and meet their public or they go on a chat show, they play the part of someone who's interested to meet you and is interested to answer these questions. And the people who can do that, the Michael Bublés, the George Clooney's, the John Hamm's, whoever it is, they're wonderful. What great sport Matt Damon is. No, that's also playing a part. When they're on Graham Norton, they're playing the part of someone who is delighted to be embarrassed with old photographs themselves.
Yes,
and delighted
of course.
It's nice to find out, I mean, with a show like this, where the first reaction to it, if you like the show, is that family they've built, you love them.
Yeah.
And they should have, the really clever thing is you love them, and it's really nice to find out that David Hyde Pierce is being lovely and understands that relationship with his fans or whatever. It shouldn't be that. This should be a glossy, cool, aspirational thing, but they've written it so well that you don't feel any of them are pricks, or you like them when they're pricks.
Yeah, but also because John Mahoney's always like telling them when they aren't being pricks, then it sort of makes it all right. They've got, you know, they're doing that work. They are completely the way in. They do that work for us.
Dad, you will not do it yourself.
I bet you don't even have any tools around here.
Oh, well, that's where you're wrong. Let me show you something, mister. Here. See this? Every possible tool for every possible need. Got this from Hammacher Schlemmer.
Is that turquoise inlay?
Yes, it also comes in ebony and onyx.
Onyx is so showy. I don't think you want onyx.
I love onyx. Onyx is a stone that resonates within me. This is why I never took any home movies.
I think the way that it just sort of develops character-wise, I remember reading a thing about it, and they were saying they want to have that, you know, who is the chemistry? Definitely going to work with Kelsey Grammer and David Hyde Pierce. And in the sort of pilot episode, there's a bit when they're having a slight sort of contretemps in the first scene, and Frasier says to Niles, when did you last have an unspoken thought, Niles? And he just says, I'm having one right now. And it just clicks. I mean, they are amazing technicians as well. I mean, I can't imagine how hard they work during their rehearsal weeks and that sort of thing. And also just, and presumably in that sort of world, when they must be really listened to as well. I mean, they are creative. Sometimes possible to sort of overlook the actual creative role of acting. And you know, there's sort of directors that it's really like, you know, incredibly prescriptive or whatever. If you're directing David Hyde Pierce or Kelsey Grammer, or presumably you've got to ask them what they think, you know, because that sort of really matters. When you know, Jane Leaves is really, she's really funny in it. You know, I suppose it's us, it's odd for us to watch a British character in an American sitcom. I mean, when you get to that sort of later episode, when you've got sort of like Robbie Coltrane and Richard E. Grant are brothers, and you're thinking, I mean, that would... that was not necessarily a casting that would happen on this side of the Atlantic.
And also, when you watch people who've done British turns in this era of very, very fast, formal American sitcom, when you put a British accent in there, it never works. Helen Baxendale always sounded wrong in Friends. The thing about Jane Leaves is she doesn't sound wrong in this. She's not putting her foot wrong. She's got the rhythms right.
I'll get it! Hey, Daphne.
Ross!
Oh, my God, you got dumb! Did you make her answer the door?
It's what she does.
Well, then she's absolutely in the that sort of Gielgud thing that some people thought was silly about knowing what play you're in.
Yeah.
That really is, that's part of it. What is the, you know, you sometimes watch things and I think if you're filming sometimes you need to go and try and get yourself on set a little bit, especially these areas of no rehearsal. You know, you go and see if you can watch the monitors for a bit and check what is the tone of this.
What
because,
am I
you
in?
Know, you read. I did a film a couple of years ago when the director actually said, I'm just not sure. You know, it was day two or three of filming. We're genuinely not sure exactly what the tone is. So we're going to film this. Can we do a really straight one, a really funny one, and somewhere in the middle? You know, these things, when things come together quickly, the money suddenly arrives and you need it spent by a certain time. You just get everyone in costume.
I remember being told that by someone at Warp, that there. When they sent Shane Meadows and Paddy Considine off to do Dead Man's Shoes, the pitch and the money was raised to make a knockabout comedy. And they came back and went, ah, we didn't get one. We've got this harrowing revenge drama. I hope it's still okay.
I had an audition for something about 4 years ago, and my agent sent me the pages, and I looked at it for quite a long time, and then I finally thought, yeah, okay, I think I sort of see what this is. And I went and I did it, and it was to play, perhaps inevitably, a priest. And I rang my agent afterwards and she said, how did it go? And she said, I think it was fine, yeah, in the end, yeah. No, I sort of got my head round it and, yeah, no, it was quite funny in the end. So and she goes, it's not funny. And I said, well, I don't know. All I've got is the two pages in front of me that to me seemed funny. Like, one of the stage directions was Paul's a face. I mean, what are you...
Right.
You know, it was slightly awkward, really, in retrospect.
should have been warned.
But not at the time, yeah. In fairness... In this day and age, it would have been easier for me to research, at the very least, the genre. you know, lesson learnt.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads. Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thank you.
within it has decided on a tone. And the tone of this is different than Cheers.
Mm-hmm.
It's
yes,
slightly
very
more,
different.
It's witty and brittle and farcical, and but it's a different thing. It's not got the same vocabulary or tone. They've chosen to do something very different with it. And I think if you've done the radio station one, you can see it when Gil and Roz and Bulldog are on set. You go, that's a Cheers.
Yeah.
Those are Cheers.
Yeah.
And they're in the key of it. But what they've done here is they've made a bunch of really clever, unexpected decisions. One, they've said, who are you going to take and spin off from Cheers? It's not Frasier. It's definitely Norman Cliff. There are a million people from Cheers that you'd spin off before you... So you take Frasier out and you go, okay, well, he's a bit brittle and pompous. What should we do? We should make him really brittle and pompous, and as a sidekick to offset that, give him someone even more brittle and pompous.
Yes.
When you think about it, our only mistake today was trying to fix that toilet ourselves.
Yes, we tampered with the natural order of things.
But now, order has been restored. By hiring a plumber, that plumber can now afford, say, a Dolly Parton album. Miss Parton can then finance a national tour, which will, of course, come to Seattle, allowing some local promoter to make enough money to send his cross-dressing teenage son to us for $150 an hour therapy.
To the circle of life.
Well, their rule for this was no stupid characters, no stupid jokes, which takes out a whole palette of colour that was in Cheers, because you had great idiot barmen and great idiot barflies.
Yeah.
So no one doesn't know things.
I suppose, but also with Frasier, you're going, well, let's give someone who would have a life outside the bar. You know, a lot of the other characters in Cheers, that's the bit of the day they're really longing for.
And they're alive there.
Do the post around, get to the bar.
That's the only thing Norm does, isn't it?
Yeah, really? Yeah, that's where they want to be. So that's their sort of, you know, whereas I suppose Frasier's slightly more fish out of water when he's in the bar.
There's a lovely moment, if you watch, I think it's first episode, series 3, of Cheers, is Frasier's introduction episode, and brilliantly he's in the bar for the whole episode. He's Diane's new boyfriend, and he's in the background, and the first time you watch it now, knowing Kelsey Grammer, you go, what, they put Kelsey Grammer in the background? He's not had any lines.
Yeah,
but he's hanging around in the bar for about 10 minutes before he steps forward and says, hello, I'm Frasier Crane, I'm Diane's new boyfriend. And it's lovely because you go, oh, any of those characters from the background of the bar could step forward.
He was just there when the music stopped.
Tell him to drop by. I'll try to fit him in between dames.
Why don't you say hello to him right now?
Hello, Sam. I'm Dr. Frasier Crane. I'm sorry I startled you.
Everyone's got an inner life, and finally from him you get a chance to go home and see his home life and things, and it's complicated and brilliant. But the real stroke of genius, which I think they did get from as a writing trick from Cheers, usually if you've got a precinct of characters or a family, you go, here's the idiot one, here's the vain one, here's the thing. And in Cheers they did a brilliant thing of often having two of them.
Well, so it means they can be competitively whatever their thing is. So if someone's really pompous but no one else is pompous, there's no of them to go. If there's someone else that's a bit more pompous, they can keep adding it.
And you get that with Niles and Frasier, where Frasier is more socially able the Niles, so he can cut. It's just so clever.
Yes. But because it rounds his edges, rounds Frasier's edges.
But the episode that you chose, series 4, episode 6, Mixed Doubles, is having so much cake and eating it in this respect, because not only is there Frasier and there is Niles, who is another Frasier, in this episode there is another Niles.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful bit of construction. It's
one that's there for the fans, isn't it? This is something that you've got, you know, they've already done, what, nearly sort of 80 episodes or whatever by the time they've done this, and suddenly there's this premise of this episode. Is Daphne is split up with a boyfriend, Niles, who's been lusting after her. Lusting is perhaps unfair. He's in love with her.
It's clearly romantic, which stops it being creepy.
He's been examining her from all angles for some years.
He says to Frasier, well, I'm going to tell her how I feel. And he's going, well, it's a bit, don't go rushing it. You know, just give it a day. And then, as it turns out, Daphne goes to a bar with Roz and then meets someone that very night. And, of course, when he turns up, he is exactly like that.
It's another novel.
It's amazing.
Give it a day, you said? Give it a day?
Yeah. And then he's just, in one day, she has found him again.
Oh, everyone, this is Rodney Banks. Dr. Niles Crane?
How do you do?
The pleasure is mine. Flu season.
Can't be too careful.
You're playing with the toys you've got in your set. And you go, what happens if you have two Nileses?
And they match physical business, don't they? They both reach for their
handkerchief. Yes, they tickets, and they both think it's their phone when it's actually.
Yeah,
that's an amazing. When he comes in and he's so like him, and the phone rings, and they're both looking for it at the same time.
Well, we've just had the most wonderful day at the marina.
Oh, you got a boat?
Actually, no. I have an inner ear curvature that makes me prone to motion sickness, but there's a charming bistro there that serves the most exquisite. Not me.
Hello. Oh, I can't talk now, Duke. I'm in the Twilight Zone.
And then it's actually the dad. Dad picks up the phone. He goes, I can't talk now, Duke. I'm in the Twilight Zone.
The handkerchief business, which I think David Hyde Pierce said it was the key to his character, that on the first day on set, he came in and he had to sit in the cafe with Frasier and be introduced as the brother, which they do brilliantly by just putting up a full screen caption, black, with the word the brother.
Yeah.
They use the captions to move exposition on fast. But he sits down and the first thing he does is he dusts off the seat with his handkerchief. And that says he's got a handkerchief, he carries a handkerchief, and he will not sit on a dirty seat.
Yeah.
And by the time he sat down, you've told him everything. And for a very verbal show, the amount of physical business that all the characters do to tell you who they are is wonderful.
But also,
he's a really good clown.
He is, in terms of his sort of comic versatility, I mean, absolutely extraordinary. You could have him as a cast member in a radio sketch show, couldn't you? And he could be in a sort of, you know, complicité show or a mime show. I mean,
well, he does that amazing thing. Is it Three Valentines, where the opening 5 minutes is him setting fire to the house?
Yeah.
Which was done because they wanted to do Mr. Bean with him. They said, could you do Mr. Bean? Yeah, because he's pompous.
And... well, have you seen the episode where there's the sword fighting? I mean, he's absolutely with the fencing with Maris's fencing coach. It's because the Maris stuff, it's very, you know, when you obviously one never sees her, and that's her sort of Mrs. Columbo kind of brilliance. And that she is just this sort of great vessel. And, you know, they say they don't. It's silly, but those ones, they always are sort of... There's one when... there's another episode I really love, the candidate, and they're telling this candidate, oh, they're doing absolutely everything that I have. My don't worry, my wife's got all the staff licking the envelopes for you at home. It's all absolutely fine. She'd join in herself, of course, but the poor thing can't produce saliva. You know, these amazing things. And stuff. When she runs, she doesn't leave footprints in snow and stuff like that. You know.
Well, they got to a point where they kept putting those lines in so you'd keep imagining this almost like supernatural
Tim
Burton-esque... character of the distance. And I think
it's amazing. It turned out that Maris was played by Johnny Depp, that would be the only. There's almost no other appropriate casting.
They put her in one of those costumes where they're backwards, so the legs go the other way. Something from Pan's Labyrinth. But they sort of describe
shades
her.
Shades of Bernie Clifton.
But someone said that an amazing actress phoned up and said, "Oh, I'd love to play the part of Maris." And they went, "We can't now." Because there's no human being who could come on set and live up to the description we've given of her, which is brilliant.
But also because Lilith, I mean, because that sort of apotheosis of sort of chill that she is, Bibb Newworth, I mean, it's absolutely amazing.
And yes, obviously, if Fraser's got a wife who is brittle and difficult and complicated, then obviously Niles's has to be exponentially more bizarre.
Yeah, but she's very sort of steely as well, isn't she?
It's a great performance. Bibb Newworth is just...
Yeah, amazing.
When they let her in. That's one of the few things where they let someone in from Cheers and you go, it completely works, because she's totally in Fraser's world.
Yeah.
You're always welcome to have Lilith in, because she was such a good point. It's always weird seeing a picture of Bibb Newworth with her hair down.
Hey, she's acting.
Turns out it can be done.
But I love the runners they sort of put in, like in the just that rule of farce about setting something up. You need to try and set it up with it, you know, like an axe before or something. Don't say, oh, don't knock over that vase, it's very expensive, smash, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
40 minutes earlier, someone needs to say, well, of course, this vase is incredibly expensive. Yeah. It would be awful if someone were to smash it. Well, you know, it's sort of compressed in sitcom terms. But that, so in this episode, Frasier's finally got the last set of these ridiculous coffee cups. That each one is a different one of the six wives of Henry VIII. And there's a moment where, during the bit where he's discovering just how alike him, the new boyfriend is, that you just suddenly hear this smash from the kitchen. And Frasier goes, Anne of Cleves? And Niles goes, Catherine of Aragon. Really, really angrily.
That joke structure, which is, as you say, sort of drop a thing in, challenge the audience to remember it, and then reward them when you do. It's all to do with flattering the audience. And the wonderful thing about this episode particularly, you're trying to get jokes out of people finishing the joke for you. The audience, you're saying, we're not going to spell the joke out. We'll allow you to join the last two dots, and then you'll feel double the laugh because you helped make it.
Yeah.
And the great thing about this episode is about will they, won't they. It's about the unsaid romance between...
Well, because it finishes really, really beautifully.
I mean, you're building towards this thing where the audience is bringing is the package of four series of knowing that Niles and Daphne are a couple where the truth cannot be said. So the audience is holding. I think if you've never seen an episode of this before, within seconds, you will know at the beginning that they are holding a candle for each other. And with that knowledge in your heart, you can finish 30 jokes for the next 10 minutes, but you are finishing them yourself because none of the characters are saying it. And it's a wonderful, generous, flattering way of doing character jokes, is to say you, the audience, own a piece of information that the characters don't.
Frasier, I'm going to tell Daphne how I feel about her.
What?
I'm going to tell her tonight.
Now, see, before you do something this rash, I mean, perhaps you should consider it from all angles.
I spent 3 years considering Daphne from all angles.
Guys, I've got a confession.
Okay.
Is it about all their murders you've done?
It's not about all their murders I've done. This is the first episode of Frasier I have ever seen. I'd never seen it before. For some reason, it had passed me by. It hadn't hit my radar. So I sat and watched this yesterday and made a few notes. Knew exactly who everybody was. It's crystal clear to a first-time viewer. And the last line of this made me cry.
Oh, that's
so
incredible.
In it. It's a sensational piece of work, and I've now got to go and watch all of Frasier.
You do. It's just really great. It's just so... There's a lot of love in it, and that thing of just everyone buying into the thing. I'm thrilled that you love it so much from just one episode. Yeah.
But the big thing about it was everything in it is crystal clear. So for a first-time viewer going in, I knew exactly who these people were. I knew what their relationships were. I could tell that he was obviously been in love with Daphne for years, I imagine. Four series, I guess.
Yeah.
And, the construction, the fact that once you've got two Nileses and they're going on double dates, you go, I know where this is going. I can see what's going to happen here. The wrong two are going to get together and the other two aren't they? Exactly what they do, and they're having so much cake and eating it. It's fantastic.
You're moving pieces.
That lovely bit where Niall spots Adele with Rodney.
Yeah.
In other words, Rodney's doing the dirty on Daphne.
Yeah.
Instead of being furious.
A rare
moment
of Only Fools and Horses crossover. Yeah. You've got Adele and Rodney.
But instead of being furious that his date is out with Rodney, he says, "How dare anybody treat Daphne?"
Yeah. It's absolutely incredible, isn't it? And the selflessness of it.
They're very good at throwing sympathy back onto characters who would otherwise be dislikable. And you go, the moment you go that, it purifies his motives with Daphne. You realise he's got this sort of white knight thing. He would do anything for her. He's a gentleman. It's not, because it could be creepy that he's got a crush on his dad's physical therapist, but it never is. It's romantic. And you realise that whether, obviously, he acts on it or doesn't act on it, it's done out of a pure love.
Yeah.
Yeah, his first thought is for her feelings.
Now, sir, look.
I don't believe it. The betrayal. No one treats Daphne like that.
But whatever you do not engage him in a physical fight. The whole thing would just look too weird.
Yeah.
Which immediately you go, well, that makes him nice again.
But also the sort of anxieties of him. There's that bit when at the beginning he's having the conversation with Frasier and he's saying, no, I'm absolutely clear. I've never felt more certain. But I can tell that I'm right because I'm actually calm. Look at my hand. And he's put one hand on a statue and he's holding out a hand in front of him that's completely still, but the one on the statue is shaking and the statue moves again across the thing.
Perhaps I'll take that brandy.
Again, because he offers him that brandy as well, doesn't he? He's like going, I don't need a brandy. I'll go, no, I would like a brandy. And then he starts getting flustered.
I've been rehearsing this for months. Daphne, something I need to talk to you about. It's a matter of... Daphne? For a long time now, you and I, exactly how's the brandy getting here? By St. Bernard?
I love watching David Hyde Pierce. I really... I think they're all brilliant. And I know it's called Frasier, but I love David Hyde Pierce, I really do.
I often wonder about that with Frasier, because it is Kelsey Grammer has been in an ensemble sitcom as a side character.
Yeah.
He's given his own show, and because the guys who write it are absolutely brilliant, they then surround him by people who can equal and better him. They build another ensemble around him, and a lot of the spotlight isn't on Frasier. Frasier gets some terrific lines and things. But I often wonder whether Kelsey Grammer's ego alone would have gone, I know it's for the good of the show, but I am being upstaged left, right and centre by some terrific... How dare they put these brilliant people with me?
No, but that's the point. You know, that's the point of sort of proper ensemble stuff. I think if you really like sort of comedy acting, you know, you want to be on stage with other people, you know, and that's what makes it. I'm in a one man play at the moment, and that's when you know you think, oh, I always look forward to acting because there'll be other people there, and then suddenly, that sense of, you know, surrounding yourself with really good people, that's the sensible thing, you know, don't just stick yourself front, you know. Victoria Wood, you know, was an amazingly brilliant person, incredibly talented, and she surrounded herself with other brilliantly talented people, and it just raises the whole thing.
What's the experience of doing a one man play like?
It's a bit odd. It's written by James Kettle, who was the head writer on the News Quiz for 10 series.
Writer.
Amazing writer. And, you know, the actual work itself, the piece, is really, really satisfying. It just, you know, it involves sort of stamina and focus and things like that. I had a press night the other night, even though we've been on the road for 5 weeks. You know, a press night. I've done about... I don't know how many sort of solo stand-up shows, but I've never had a thing where it's, you know, effectively a press night. Having a press night, a theatre press night, when you're the only person in it, is... I did afterwards say to the stage manager, I don't think I can be in a play again. I'm not sure I could cope with that level of pressure again. So that those moments, but it's, you know, it's great fun. But you find yourself wanting, right now I want to be in a thing with other people, and I think that kind of the ensemble thing, it makes all of them better.
Yeah,
it would be mad for Kelsey Grammer to think, you know, wouldn't it be great if everyone else wasn't as good as this? You know, because they're all elevated. And there were episodes that he wrote and directed. You know, he really tried to write some episodes when he was away ill at one point, and they were, he sort of couldn't really write for Frasier. He discovered he could write for the other characters. That's what he liked doing. And I think when you've got a voice, like I did this radio thing, In and Out of the Kitchen, and when
was great.
Oh, thanks very much. Thank you. In the first series, I had this sort of vague idea for casting, but it wasn't quite right probably. It was just I sort of thought, right, what megastars are with my agency? They'll all be in it. And I wasn't really thinking. And then when we actually did it, you know, we had these fantastic people, Philip Fox and Justin Edwards, Selena Cadell. And I just used to, when I started writing it, second and third series, I just had their voices in my head. So to write for Philip Fox and to write for Justin and Selena, in a way, it's sort of Frasier-esque, that really, you know, the characters in that is too... men who live together, and they're kind of, you know, that they're sort of Niles and Frasier, and then there's the builder that's always there, Mr. Mulaney. He's effectively the dad. You know, there's a kind of there's a sort of Roz character, I suppose, Marion Duffett, who is also a producer. You know, I suppose there's a template, obviously, that has gone over that if one looks at it retrospectively. But the strength of the ensemble in this, but also the wider ensemble. You know, if you look at the credits, if you're the sort of person who looks at the credits, you've got people that have written the storyline one week, they've produced the next week, they've done the teleplay the next week. You know, that sort of utility player, they can all do all these different jobs.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they can all run writers' rooms, they can all turn out drafts, they can all do the punch-ups, they can all... And it means they're all across... The people that make the programme and write the programme have just got all these different skills, and they can sort of, you know, they can storyline the whole thing and say, right, you do that bit, we'll do that. They're absolutely, you know, they really are.
There are the guys, I mean, they talk brilliant. About the team, and sort of, there were people who were just absolute plot Nazis and things, but you can see that people in there who really are able to do form or fast, which is a very difficult thing to write.
Well, episodes like that, you've got to watch an episode, the Ski Lodge.
Pure doors opening fast. I mean, it's
exceptional. And it has an American guy playing a French character who is just, he is astonishing. It's an incredible piece of work.
Can't we just have a nice, relaxing ski trip? Does this whole weekend have to be about sex?
Hello.
Hello.
I am Guy.
Daphne. Amy.
I hope you're ready to ski tomorrow. I'm going to work you very hard.
Oh. Dibs on the Frenchman.
It really is.
But there's a sort of theatrical formality to it. But it also, it plays with stuff that is quite high risk in sitcom, because with sitcom you want absolute clarity. I like all the rules it breaks. You want absolute clarity of status and things. And everyone in here is high status in something and low status in something. There aren't simple status things. Everyone here is obviously socially sort of fairly high status.
Yeah.
And even you know, Martin, well, he's the dad, so he's high status even though his class is lower.
But he's a policeman. Grown up.
And he's a proper grown up. And Roz is more sexually.
Of course,
able.
The policeman aspect of it. Yeah, yeah, you've got that. He's literally an authority figure.
Yeah,
you know?
And obviously in.
I mean, all
Cheers,
Frasier does, he hosts a phone in show. He's got this period, you know, and that's why he has that sort of thing with Niles. It's like, well, Niles, I'm a proper psychiatrist, whereas you're doing a radio show.
One of them went to Harvard and one of them went to Yale. And one's a Jungian and one's a Freudian. So basically they're doing the same job, but they're instantly rivals in every way. But also Martin, who I think in Cheers, Frasier's dad is dead and was an eminent psychiatrist.
Yeah.
And they went, when they came to Frasier, they went, it won't work. We can't have another psychiatrist. So they said, what's the funniest thing? And then you can build a fish out of water into his own home, because there's someone in his own home in whose world he doesn't fit.
People around here take a lot of pride in this town. They don't appreciate some radio know-it-all telling them it's rainy and depressing.
In case you haven't noticed, Dad, it does get a little damp around here. For God's sake, the state flower is mildew.
Let me tell you something. A city's like a woman. You get one mad at you, it doesn't matter if you're completely right and she's completely wrong, you apologize anyway or you'd be paying for it for the rest of your life.
I'm not sure I care for that analogy.
Oh, gee, I'm sorry, Daphne. I was way out of line.
All right, you're forgiven.
That's an interesting dynamic, that, isn't it? The notion of blue-collar parent with white-collar children. Yeah. You know, it's, yeah. I think it's... I think it's the American dream.
You can move classes.
But also the fact that he is... times just slightly disappointed by it.
Yeah.
There's lots of lovely scenes where he talks about his wife. You know, when he's talking about the chair, you know, he was like, you know, that's, I want to sit in the chair I was sitting in when I saw Neil Armstrong land on the moon. And, you know, when your mother told me she was pregnant with you and all these sorts of things. There's this sort of love story there, of course, that we've never seen any of. And he basically, the way he says, all the you know, the classy stuff you get for your, from your mum, she had sort of taste and that sort of thing. And he talks about this woman that he was sort of totally in love with. And then the flip side of that, you have all the stuff about them that is white collar, is he finds genuinely disappointing. It's great, you know, they've got all these certificates on the wall, but they can't fucking catch, you know. And that's really upsetting.
The cold open in this, which is where they're looking out the window through the telescope as if they're spying on a nude woman.
Yeah.
And sort of lusting after it, after something they can see in the distance. And it's a Brancusi armchair.
Yeah, yeah.
And the dad is disappointed that it's not a woman putting her bra. That's what I'm saying. I'm disappointed in you.
It's so upsetting for him that they don't conform to all sort of societal norms in that. There's a great one where Fraser buys this painting by this sort of fabulous lady, and it turns out it's not by her. And he only discovers this when he has an unveiling of the painting at the flat. The artist is there. He's very pleased. And she says, "This is not my painting. You know, it's a sort of fake. It's done in her style." And he's absolutely livid about it. Martin says, he's like, "What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? What do I do?" And he's like, "Well, you've got to call the police, haven't you?" And he picks up the phone and starts dialing. He says, "Who do I talk to?" And he says, "Oh, ask them to put you through to the art fraud department." And he goes, "Oh, this is going to put me through the art fraud department." And then you can just hear, he doesn't know quite what's going on. He realises that someone at the end of the phone is laughing. And Martin goes, "Yeah, put him onto me, put him onto me." And it's a mate of his that's picked up the phone. And of course, he's like, "It's not a real problem. What you're talking about is not, this is not a problem that sort of matters. The Seattle police do not have an art fraud department if you ring their kind of 911, you know."
"Do people ever come up to you after they've met me and say, 'How can that guy be your father? He's nothing like you?'"
"Well..."
"Because they've been saying that to me about you for the last 40 years.
It's him being the voice of the normal world, which again, Roz does. The two of them work really well as little voices. Even in the precinct, when he goes to the office, you've got Gil, who is even more pompous and silly than he is, and then Bulldog, who is just like a super Martin, like the worst version of Martin there could be.
Yeah, yeah.
They place it where they double up roles to sort of show off that, well, Martin may be a bit rough, but he's not Bulldog.
Yes.
Fraser might be a bit of a prick, but he's not Gil.
Well, the characters, they have they sort of take the edges off each other sort of all the time. Yeah, right, there's an episode called the Radio Ham, again, and your sort of wish list, which is really, and that's where it's the sort of anniversary of the station, and they try and do a sort of live radio drama Fraser directs, and he gets very uptight. And Gil Chesterton, classical music and food critic, is he? And he's
bow tie.
He's sort of fairly, sort of flamboyant, and he has these lines that he's absolutely desperate to get in because he starts doing it bigger and bigger. Eventually, they start killing each other off during the radio, and it's very Martin's listening. It's an absolute bloodbath, you know. But he has this bit that he always has this line that he loves delivering.
"When the lights came back up, Nigel Fairservice lay mortally wounded."
"I'm dying."
"Poor man was gone.
Never again to revisit the scene of my boyhood in Surrey. Romping with my school chums and the Fens and Spinnies."
"Just then, the lights went out again. The final bullet blew his head clean off his shoulders."
Which is sort of absolutely Americans writing about British sort of cultural life, but it's... No, it's an absolute treat, and there's just a lot of it. I think when he died last year, was it? I remember just suddenly feeling really upset.
Yeah.
I just thought, oh, gosh, this really really matters to me, this programme.
There's a lot of generosity in this. There's generosity towards the characters. They like them. It would be very easy to the lazy thing would be to do, well, there's no story here because we're judging him. He's a prick. But what you've got in this show is this family is lovable. He is lovable. The characters love him. So when someone says, "You remind me of Fraser," they're not just saying, "Oh, you've got some of those qualities." They're also saying,
You're an
real
asshole. You're an asshole, but I like you.
Yeah,
but like someone saying, "Oh, watch, you should watch Friends. You really remind me of Gunter the Barman.
Ugly or naked guy.
You really remind me of Ugly Naked Guy."
Exactly. It's not a full sucker. Who we never
seen, but just from the description of him, you really remind me.
He's the Maris. Yeah. Maris of Friends. But yeah, it's there's a generosity to it, and also generosity to the audience. And they had a policy, which they said was 10 percenters. There were jokes in this that they knew 10% of the audience would like, and yeah. Screw 90%, because there'll be another joke in a minute. And they were prepared to do that, which is very unusual in American network comedy, because everything's tested, and you're terrified that if one joke flies over the audience's head, they'll turn off.
Yeah.
And I think as an audience member, you get that feeling that they are talking
to
you.
There's a Latin pun in it at one point, which Niles came up with, these nine, which is something like semper ubi sub ubi, which is just always wear underwear. You know, and that's... And that's just in a very sort of basic Latin, but yeah, that's
a 10%.
It's ludicrous. Is it even a 10%? Yeah.
There's a lovely Kelsey Grammer. I've just found this quote from Kelsey Grammer. He said that Jack Benny always used to say, "Play up to your audience," and that was the hallmark of the show. Assume they know better.
Yeah.
And that's so rare. And at the same time, apparently they put the dog in. They put Eddie the dog in because someone had said...
Who we've not even mentioned.
Well, they put Moose as Eddie the dog in. Apparently, when they had those things where they play it to an audience and they put those approval dials, that every time an animal goes on screen, the approval dials always go up. So they cynically put a dog in, knowing that if it got nothing at all, it would still have overall some spikes in it. Yeah. And it was done as insurance. It was cynically put in as insurance. And then you go, but the way you use that dog, it's brilliant.
A friend of mine, a director, saying recently she was involved in something, and she said, I said, that's interesting project. And she said, look, I mean, the fact of the matter is no film about a dog has ever lost money. I don't know if that's true. In a way, I hope it is. It would just be an amazing certainty to know that there are, at a time like this, to know there are some certainties out there. If you think about those films that lost, famously sort of lost a lot of money.
Waterworld 2, Dog World.
Yeah, if Santa Claus the Movie had been called Dog the Movie. Or
Heaven's Gate in Dogs. Can I tell you the only thing that I didn't like about it?
Mm. Yeah.
Was the music.
Ah.
Because it said on the end credits, sung by Kelsey Grammer, and I thought, no, it's not. That should be sung by Fraser Crane, shouldn't it? Surely this is the kind of thing he would sing if he were in a karaoke club or something.
Yes.
Apparently, someone said that's the thing they get asked most about is the end theme. He said that people just ask him, what's it mean, what's it about, and it was just filler. It's him messing about. You're right, it's in characters, what he would do on his piano.
Yeah.
A bluesy thing to show off. It's supposedly about therapy, isn't it? Because the central joke of Fraser is that he's a therapist who gives advice to people whose life is a mess.
Yeah.
So the central joke is he's dealing with people who are mentally scrambled.
Yeah.
But I suppose it's sort of like, it is a funny theme.
I think we can go as far to say it's not as good as the Cheers theme.
Yeah, I think we can say that.
I hope I'm not being controversial. Yeah. It's not a controlled experiment, is it? Yeah.
But I don't know what to do with those tossed salads and scrambled eggs. They're calling again. Frasier has left the building.
They've built this amazing ensemble, and from various angles they've run it past so that the farce can work. And for a farce to work, the audience need to know what everyone is going to do, so that when they do it, you're delighted, and when they don't do it, you're equally delighted and confounded, and it's just a joy. And as you said, you watched this from a standing start and knew what everyone was going to do.
Yep.
The bit where Roz greets Daphne at the door and hugs her in
she
an intimate
knows.
Way.
Yep.
Oh, you've been dumped, and all the men have been had trouble understanding her. Two of whom are supposed to be psychiatrists.
Yeah, yeah.
There's That's so right, many yeah. levels of joke in the way that two of the side characters hug each other. It's so cleverly balanced. And some of that is the ensemble. Some of that is the writing. It is a magical combination.
I was surprised, watching this back the other way, surprised at how many jokes that Fraser makes at Roz's expense, which I wondered if it dated it very slightly. You know, she says to her, Daphne, I'm going to take you to a bar. I call it the Sure Thing. And he says, oh, how flattering, they've named a bar after her. And you think, yeah, it's a bit sort of relentless.
She's very resilient to it.
Well, she's just better than them.
Yeah. Have you heard the casting rundown for Roz? Because if we're all saying how much we love Roz, and we love Roz.
Well, Lisa Kudrow played
Lisa Kudrow was
for a
up
few
to,
days.
Yeah, she was up to the last two. But the casting list that got to Perry Gilpin, Alison Janney,
wow.
Patricia Clarkson, Hope Davis, Janine Garofalo, Salma Hayek, and the last two standing, Perry Gilpin and Lisa Kudrow. And Lisa Kudrow got Friends weeks after losing Roz.
She did start filming after a couple of days, didn't
they? Started changing the character to fit her delivery. And
Perry Gilpin had taken
it.
Lisa Kudrow out for lunch to congratulate her on getting the role of Roz Dyer.
Really? Well,
but it would have been a very different character. I don't think anyone else could have done it. And there's something in her that is missing from all the other... Every one of these characters has got something that's missing from all the other ones.
Yeah,
And her earthiness and her unashamedness Yeah. All the rest of them are bottles of neuroses.
It's the Wizard of Oz, isn't it? There's all one thing that they're looking for each time. One of them needs courage, one of them needs a heart.
Yeah.
One of them needs a wizard, is that right? A very long time since I've seen it.
I think is it Eddie the dog who needs a wizard?
That's how it's formally.
Actually, you can always hang things over the Wizard of Oz.
See the way he's slurping his orange juice? Sloppy kisser. Now, you can tell right away the guy is no good in bed. He's so cautious. Look at the way he's blowing on his coffee.
I wasn't trying to cool it. I was simply blowing a foam hole.
You don't even wrinkle the sheets, do you?
The reputation it has for being a formally excellent farce.
Yeah.
Probably might even put some people off watching it because you'd go, oh, is it going to be clever?
Yeah, it's
not. It's just clever.
No, it's just really clever. I mean, they keep stacking
as opposed
to
clever. It's really
They keep stacking the dilemmas up, don't they? So that even when in the last scene with Niles and Daphne, she then starts basically destroying Niles by going, "Well, I should never have been with a guy like that, should I?" And you go, "Oh God, you've found more dilemmas in this."
Yeah.
I'll have everything just so. He's nuts about cleanliness. Then there's his clothes, his precious shoes.
I don't like this road we're on.
I mean, what if it was one of those people that, you know, how awful to come rushing in like that. What a dreadful, you know, he made a real mistake that night.
Men can be such an unfeeling lot. Look at Rodney. The minute he heard I'd just broken up with someone, he moved right in for the kill. Is that how all men are?
No, not all men.
No, of course they aren't. You're not. You're kind, sensitive. If you ask me, you were too good for that, Adele.
Thank you, Daphne. Now, the truth is, my heart was never really in that relationship.
I thought it might not be.
Again, the audience is bringing loads of knowledge to there, and it's all playing in David Hyde Pierce's face, and it's playing in the way he delivers things. And there's tragedy.
They're threatening collapse the whole time. Yeah. They're pushing this thing right towards the edge of collapse, and it never gets there because it's so cleverly done.
But that last scene where they're in the bar talking to each other, which leads towards the line that is beautiful... There's everything in there because you're talking here about something which is very fashionable in comedy now, which is long arcs, drama within comedy and things. It allows itself that and it plays it hilariously. It doesn't stop being funny, but it's incredibly heartfelt and incredibly sincere and you ache for them.
Yeah.
And because the scene before in that bar, it's sort of funny. So you think, oh, this is a funny place. You know, he's there with Roz and she's saying, look, turn to the girl next to you and you've got, just tell her, you've just basically just ask her about herself and, you know, find her fascinating. That's what you've got to do. And he turns around and says, what's your name? Is that Delwood? Yeah. Is that one L or two? It's two. Really?
But you've been set up to expect that. And then they do something intimate and fragile and clever, but totally heartfelt. And it ends on the line he's been waiting to hear.
Yeah.
Well, I would have said, is this seat taken? And you would have said no. And you would have said, my name is Daphne. And I would have said, my name is Niles. And then I would have said, what are you doing for the rest of your life?
You always know just the right thing to say. Oh, I love you, Dr. Crane.
I love you too, Daphne.
Hey, baby, I hear the blues are calling. No laugh.
No laugh, just pain and ache, and everyone's been there. It's just so beautifully done.
Absolutely wonderful.
It contains an absolute truth. And again, it's two psychiatrists who are after their job is to tell people, as he says at the beginning, you have to be honest, you have to say how you feel. It's all about saying how you feel, and it ends. Again, formal beauty. The beginning, Fraser says, say how you feel, let it out. At the end of it, they say how they feel and let it out, and it's still painful.
And it solved nothing.
Which is, I mean, that is just, you have to stand back in awe of how well put together these are.
Yeah.
They're wonderful shows.
My next choice is The Vicar of Dibley.
Right, okay, next down. Thank you so much for bringing
in Fraser. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Thanks, Miles.
Cheers.